From the KBIA Health and Wealth Desk, I'm Bram Sable-Smith. The mortality rate in Missouri prisons has risen 70% in 13 years. To address the increase, the Missouri Hospice and Palliative Care Association has worked with Missouri prisons to train inmates to care for their dying peers. KBIA's Aviva Okasan-Haberman takes us inside Jefferson City's prison hospice.
Kevin Dial has spent the last 18 years behind bars. When he was locked away for murder, he didn't expect to help other inmates come to terms with their death. And yet there he was, holding a friend's hand as he took his last breath.
He's looking at me and he grabs my hand, he holds my hand, and he starts, I think he starts doing hiccuping. He's like, and he's smiling, and I'm talking to him, and I'm, are you okay? Are you okay? And he's just smiling and looking at me, and at that time, he's passing on.
Dial is a volunteer for the hospice care unit in the Jefferson City Correctional Center. He helps dying inmates use the restroom, take a shower, and read some letters from home. Beyond physical help, Dial provides emotional support.
This is the hospice room.
The walls are concrete. The toilet is metal. The lighting is fluorescent. But there's a small window to the outside world. You can see the sky beyond the barbed wire fence. At the end of the room is a medical bed, what many inmates consider a luxury. This is where prisoners go to die.
We try to make it so it doesn't seem like a prison cell. For me, as a hospice worker, I don't want them to focus on their dying in prison.
But they are. It's a reality Joe Allred doesn't want to accept. He'll need hospice care soon. He has an aggressive form of prostate cancer. He says his doctors tell him he has 3 months left.
My daughter's what keeps me going, and talking to her, writing letters and visits and stuff, so.
Prison staff member Elmoli Dittman says Allred isn't in the hospice care unit yet.
He doesn't want to go. He doesn't want to give in to his disease.
Allred is prolonging the inevitable, but his diagnosis will catch up to him. When it does, volunteers like Dial will take care of him.
We are in this dump with them. We know how it feels to be locked in a cell. We know how it feels to get on the phone and not be able to reach our family, to go through this holiday season and be sad and depressed.
This ability to empathize makes the program effective, according to DeLois Williams. She helped start the program and says just because you're in prison doesn't mean you should die alone.
After taking care of my mother and my husband during their death, it just makes me realize everyone needs somebody with them. And we cannot just look at the crime.
Linda Redford studies prison hospice care and helped train the volunteers. She says the hospice program gives them a purpose.
They feel like, well, I can't do anything to help the people I victimized, but I can give back and feel like I'm contributing.
Dial says he used to think volunteering would make up for his crime.
Because I took a life, and I thought, well, maybe helping someone through this process might alleviate some of the remorse that I have. No, it doesn't. I will always be labeled a murderer. So I accept that. So I do what I can in here.
For KBIA, I'm Aviva Okasan-Haberman.
Black farmers have been slowly disappearing from American agriculture, and today they represent just about 1% of American farmers. KBIA's Aaron McKinstry visited Dr. Thomas Cooper, one of just 324 African American farmers left in Missouri. He's a fourth-generation farmer who sells a handful of calves each year and has taught his children and his grandchildren to farm.
I was born in a little place called Hayti, Missouri, in the boot hill. But I really wasn't born in Hayti. I was born out in a little old rural area called Ingram's Ridge, whatever that means. And my great-great-grandfather was a farmer. My grandfather was a farmer, my dad was a farmer, and then I'm a farmer. It's been farming in our blood forever.
About 65 cattle roam Tom Cooper's 100-acre farm. Walnut trees and cow paddies dot the pasture, which dips into a small lake in the middle, Off in the distance, Interstate 70 and signs for a Motel 6 and an Arby's provide a gentle reminder of the nearby town. But on Cooper's farm, it's easy to forget the traffic. Things feel older and quieter. Cars are replaced with the hum of a tractor. Cows come running when Cooper calls.
I'm not a part of no beef market. I don't believe in Angus. Look at my cows. I believe in diversity. I got black ones, red white face, black white face, and boy, they all taste the same. I can tell you that.
12 giant hay bales line the back wall of the barn where Dr. Cooper stands. He says when his granddaughters visit, they often scramble to the top of the pyramid of hay, which stacks all the way to the ceiling. While chewing on a blue toothpick, Cooper explains how he came to own his cattle farm just outside of Fulton, Missouri.
One thing my father always told me, said, listen, we grew up on a farm. He said, farming is a way of life, it's not a living. And so that farming at that time wasn't an option for me. I didn't want to be a farmer. And so I went to school, and at that time, for blacks, you know, most of the good jobs, either you be a physician or you be a teacher.
Cooper went to Lincoln to study teaching and met his wife. Both joined the military, and while there, he met lots of black doctors that challenged him to go back to school and become a doctor himself. He got his medical degree from the University of Missouri and then moved to Fulton to practice family medicine. After about 10 years, he started working in the emergency room.
I did about 24 years of the emergency room, went blind, and then I have been doing nothing but farming. I never quit farming, and I've been farming ever since.
Cooper and his family bought their farm a little over 30 years ago while he was still working as a doctor. He wanted to be sure that his four children learned how to farm. But, he said, when he tried to buy equipment, he couldn't get a loan.
Now, you know, there were some things that was not available to me as a black guy. Like, I couldn't go down to the Farmers Home Administration and get land. I can't speak for all blacks, but I can tell you about, I had brothers that farmed in Southeast Missouri, and family members that farmed in Southeast Missouri had a tough time getting stuff. If they could have gotten a little bit of something, they could have done what needed to be done and to be survivors.
Cooper gets up every morning at 4. He walks 10 to 12 miles a week at the Y. He checks on the farm mid-morning and does work every afternoon. He says there's always something that needs to be done.
It just means so much to me to be in charge. Now, you know, I'm not a thing for power, you know, because I know any one of these animals anytime can run me over. But, you know, you can coax them and you can teach them and you can do it right about things, and they'll do treat you right, too.
Aaron McKinstry, KBIA News.
Rural hospitals are chronically hard to keep open. Desperate to stay in business and keep serving their communities, two Missouri hospitals recently handed over their operations to a private company that promised to turn them around. But the approach that company is using is unusual, and it's gotten hospitals in other states in hot water. In collaboration with KCUR and KPIA, SideEffects Public Media's Bram Sable-Smith reports.
City Hall in Fulton, Missouri was packed when Jorge Perez was introduced in September. He stood shyly at the podium as he received a standing ovation. He had just saved the only hospital in the county. It was scheduled to shut its doors that week, which would have made Fulton the country's 20th rural community to lose its hospital in the past 2 years alone. Instead, it joined the growing list of hospitals rescued by Jorge Perez.
We travel all over the country, and we see this same thing that we see here in Fulton, you know, a town that's fighting to keep their hospitals right now.
At a time when rural hospitals are struggling, Perez has bought close to 20 of the facilities in states including Kansas, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Florida. He thinks he can make them profitable. By next year, he wants to own 50.
Part of our secret sauce is that, you know, we'll bring in new services that didn't exist before.
But one of those services is raising serious questions at a different rural hospital, Putnam County Memorial in Unionville, Missouri. In September 2016, one of Perez's companies took over the hospital. Days later, a separate company incorporated in Florida and started billing for laboratory work through Putnam Memorial, including for work that was not conducted there. Within 6 months, the hospital generated $92 million. By comparison, it generated less than $8 million the year before. The change raised flags with the state's auditor, Nicole Galloway.
It appears that Putnam County Memorial Hospital is being used as a shell company for questionable lab activity that's occurring across the country.
In August, Galloway issued a scathing report questioning the lab billings. 80% of the revenue went to private lab companies, some with business ties to Perez.
The majority, the significant majority of these billings occurred for patients that have never been to Putnam County Memorial Hospital, have never even been to Missouri.
Galloway turned her findings over to criminal authorities, including the FBI. Jorge Perez says he runs a similar program at some of his other hospitals, and he defended the practice, saying not only is it legal, there's even a book written about how to do it.
And we had numerous attorneys review that, and the only other opportunity this hospital had to survive was for them to put a lab outreach program.
Michigan healthcare attorney Brian Bauer has seen several of these types of arrangements in the past 2 years. He says while they may be legal, there's a catch. Insurance companies typically cut small rural hospitals a deal, paying them at higher rates. But when they make those deals, insurers are not anticipating this kind of high-volume lab program and its tens of millions of dollars in extra revenue.
The insurance companies usually object, taking the position, well, this isn't the volume that we agreed to.
And that's the real risk for Putnam County. Insurance companies may try to recoup their money. In fact, right now, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Mississippi is suing a rural hospital, as well as several lab companies, for nearly $34 million over a similar lab program. But these arrangements may not leave hospitals with the resources to repay.
So you have the hospital in this uncomfortable situation.
In Putnam County, less than 15% of the lab proceeds stayed with the hospital. So while Perez's company says $6 million of the hospital's debt has been paid off since it took over, there's a lot more money on the line if insurers come asking for their money back. And at least two may be looking to do just that. Bram Sablesmith, Side Effects Public Media.
For a rural hospital struggling to stay financially viable, obstetric services, which can be costly, are often among the first programs to get cut. More than half of the country's rural counties no longer have a place to give birth. But women in those counties don't stop having children. In part three of his series, Urgent for Care, Side Effects Public Media's Bram Sablesmith reports on what happens when maternity units go away.
3 years ago, the only maternity ward in Pemiscot County, Missouri, closed down. So when Sarah Scantling went into labor this summer, she had to drive.
I had the option of Blauvel.
About 40 miles south, down in Arkansas.
Dyersburg.
30 miles east in Tennessee.
Kennett.
20 miles west.
Or possibly Poplar Bluff.
70 miles away. She chose the hospital in Dyersburg, putting her 30 miles away from home and away from her family when her daughter Abilene was born.
And I knew something was wrong when she didn't cry. And then they just rushed her away.
Abilene unexpectedly had a hole in her heart. She was taken even farther from home on a medical flight to a hospital in Memphis, 130 miles away.
I didn't get to hold her for 2 days. I got to say goodbye to her, and that's it.
9 months earlier, when Scantling learned she was pregnant, she didn't know that the county hospital had closed its maternity unit. She thought she'd deliver with Erica Sheffer, the family doctor who helped her through her first pregnancy and through postpartum depression. 6 years ago, Dr. Sheffer and her husband, who's an OBGYN, were recruited to the public hospital in this small rural county to modernize its obstetrics unit.
We were making improvements. We were getting new equipment, new nurses, sending the nurses for more training. And probably 2 years into it, things started going south.
The hospital lost over $3 million in 2013. To stay alive, it started to cut some of its more costly programs, and obstetrics was the first to go.
We all felt it was coming.
That's not exactly surprising for researchers like Katie Cozumanel of the University of Minnesota.
There were 179 rural counties that lost in-county hospital obstetric services between 2004 and 2014.
There are many reasons rural delivery units become too costly to keep around. Medicaid, for example, pays hospitals much less for child delivery than private insurance does. And Medicaid pays for over half of all rural births. Plus, birth rates in rural counties are dropping, just like their overall populations.
And as numbers fall, it becomes harder and harder to maintain the staffing and the skills that are needed to be ready for a birth at any time. And the way that those communities respond differs pretty dramatically.
At the Pemiscot County Hospital in Missouri, Dr. Sheffer does still see pregnant women, but only for 32 weeks. Then she refers them out to a different doctor at a different hospital to finish their prenatal care and to deliver if they can make it.
Sometimes they don't have a way to get to the new doctor and just show up when it's time to deliver, and sometimes that's by ambulance because that's the only way they have to get there.
Hospitals in this area have a name for that, drop-in deliveries.
Hey, Booker, is her hungry again?
Sarah Scantling was fortunate. First, because she had someone who could drive her to appointments, and also because the Tennessee hospital accepted her Missouri Medicaid. She's back in Pemiscot County now, and she takes a little Abilene to see Dr. Sheffer, sometimes even just to double-check that the baby girl is all right.
There was times where I would come up here and be like, just listen to her heart. And they were like, honey, she's just asleep.
It's relieving, she says, to be back with a doctor who knows her family so well. Bram Sablesmith, Side Effects Public Media.
It's Rebecca Smith from the KBIA newsroom in Columbia, and it's time for Missouri Health Talks, a project where we listen in on Missourians' conversations about access to health care. Over the next few weeks, we'll be taking a close look at access to care for homeless people, both in the Columbia area and throughout the rural parts of the state. This week, we hear from Robert Nichols in Columbia. He was recently diagnosed with lung cancer, has undergone numerous medical procedures throughout his life, including a colostomy, and he's homeless. Robert spoke about some of the barriers that stand between him and care. Here's Robert.
I expect nobody to feel sorry for me. Only respect me. Respect me for who I am and what I am. Don't kick me when I'm down. Have you ever thought about how demeaning it is to have to sit here and ask people for change, to ask people for help? I don't want to hurt my family. I don't want to hurt nobody. I just want life, and the life that's right now that I got sucks. I don't fear nothing other than not being loved, not being cared about. I mean nothing, nobody. Does anybody understand the way that feels? I just want people to understand that being homeless don't mean I'm below you. Just means financial reason says I can't afford a home. I have no job, I'm not able to work, but yet Social Security won't help me. People look down on you like as if you ain't doing something right. And I don't know what I'm doing wrong. I really don't know. I can't work. I got messed up stomach, I got a messed up leg. I've had medical problems all my life. I just wish I could spend the rest of my life in a hospital, because at least people care. They treat me with respect. They all call me sir. You know, I'm not a sir, I'm just a homeless person. But they treat me like I matter. And that's more than I get out here. Homeless people does not mean criminals. Homeless people mean circumstances determine that they can't afford to live no other way. I'm not a mean person. I'm not a bad person. I'm a homeless person. I'm a person that believes that love thy neighbor the way you want to be loved. Give respect to people, no matter what race, color, creed, sex, anything about it. Give respect to other people. That's all that really matters. I can ask anybody that's out there that's listening to this to say a prayer. Not only me, but all the people out here. There's probably over 500 people that's homeless out here that nobody knows about. Nobody cares about.
That was Robert Nichols speaking about the stigma around homelessness and about the barriers he faces getting health care. That's it for this week's Missouri Health Talks, which was reported and produced by Jonah McKeown. Tune in next week for more conversations from throughout the state about health and access. I'm Rebecca Smith. Thanks for listening. It's Rebecca Smith from the KBIA Newsroom in Columbia, and it's time for Missouri Health Talks, a project where we listen in on Missourians' conversations about access to health care. This week we hear from Columbia resident Max Lewis and Leslie Anderson with Services for Independent Living. They spoke about a significant change Missouri is making and how it supports people who need assistance to stay in their home. In the past, if you were on Medicaid, the state would pay for someone to help an elderly or disabled person with personal care, up to the cost of living in a nursing home. But starting July 1st, the state will only pay up to 60% of what it would cost to live in a nursing home. There are a very limited number of waivers for people that would allow them to keep their full care, but it's a tiny fraction of the estimated 8,800 Missourians who need those services. For the rest, it may mean getting fewer hours of assistance or ending up in a nursing home. Max is quadriplegic and currently receives this care.
And I get about 6 hours of attendant care a day, slightly over that. And those 6 hours are absolutely necessary for my functioning. I used to have to worry whether or not I was going to get up in the morning, whether or not I was going to make it to class when I was in school, whether or not I was going to make it to a doctor's appointment. I mean, if someone doesn't come, I stay flat on my back without food or water necessity to survive. And a lot of times I would have to yell for help. I would lay in bed and I'd go, "Help!" And that, in fact, happened the first day I moved into Paquin with a home health care agency. They never showed up. And at about 9 a.m., I started yelling for help really loud about every 10 seconds. And by 10 a.m., that was about every 5 minutes I yelled for help. And then by 11 a.m., I just listened for somebody out in the hall I thought I could hear. And finally, someone up on the next floor heard me. And it was a maintenance person. They came down and they found somebody in the building that was just kind enough to just throw some clothes on me and put me in my wheelchair. When it comes to the basic necessities of life, I'm completely dependent. And without that, I would cease to exist, period.
So how is all of this changing you as a person?
As an individual, fortunately, I believe I may get the independent waiver. If I wasn't going to get the independent waiver, how would that change me as an individual? I don't know. I think I'd be contemplating nursing home too. And even if, I don't know, my future would be largely undetermined come July the 1st. I, along with other individuals, hopefully are going to get more involved in the process and hopefully speak out about the concerns and the needs for individuals with disability. It's sort of that cry or die thing. Cry for help or die. That's what it comes down to. I'm laying in the bed again that first morning and nobody's come to get me up. So am I gonna start yelling for help? Or am I just gonna lay there and die?
From KBIA News in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Sarah Shariari. Have you heard there's a total solar eclipse coming to mid-Missouri? It seems like everybody is talking about it, and we're no exception. Recently, MU professor and director of astronomy Angela Speck sat down with me and my colleague, Harvest Public Media reporter Chris Husted. We talked about why the chance to see a total solar eclipse is so rare, how scientists and citizens are preparing to gather information, and how animals and plants might react to the sudden darkness. Here's our conversation. Angela, can you tell me what is an eclipse and how are people in different parts of the world going to experience this differently as opposed to people here in central Missouri?
A solar eclipse happens when the moon gets between us and the sun. And there are different types of eclipses. It's much more common to see a partial eclipse than it is to see a total eclipse. When we have an eclipse, and we have them happening somewhere on the planet almost every year. It's basically about once a year, but it's just less than that. That happens, but the place that gets to see that total eclipse is only about 0.1% of the surface of the Earth. Mm-hmm. So even though they happen every year in a given location, they're very rare. And so in terms of what people get to see in different places, actually, the U.S. is the only country that sees totality, where it's actually totally eclipsed. But as you move away from the place where you can see the total eclipse, you can imagine that, you know, just outside of that area, you're in a place where most of the sun gets blocked out. And as you move further away, less and less of the sun is blocked out. So in this case, we'll have, you know, a 90% eclipse in places like Denver or Chicago. And then as we move further out, even in Maine, which is as far away as you can get from the path of totality and still be on mainland U.S., you're going to get about a 50% eclipse. But all the way to, you know, it encompasses the whole of Canada, the whole of Central America, Greenland, the Caribbean, northern South America. There's even a little piece of Western Europe and West Africa that will see a partial eclipse. So, you know, in the U.S., on the mainland, it's at least 50% and up to 100%. And then even Alaska and Hawaii get a 20% eclipse. So it's going to be experienced by, you know, the Western Hemisphere in some way or other over most of that. And it's going to be the most watched celestial event ever.
Really? And is that just because people are more aware of it now? Or?
Right. I mean, if you think about, like, say, it's something that it happens every year, but often they're in places that are very inaccessible. And so this is one where it's over an area that's quite heavily populated, but also technological. And we now have social media. The last time we had an eclipse on U.S. soil was 1991. That was in Hawaii. Well, I didn't even have email in 1991.
From the KBIA newsroom in Columbia, I'm Ryan Femuliner. For more than 200 years, millions of tons of lead were mined from a region in southeast Missouri called the Old Lead Belt. During the mining, heavy metals seeped into the waterways that flowed through the region and out to the Mississippi River. But as part of our series, The Legacy of Lead, KBIA's Christopher Husted reports those waterways are still dealing with contamination long after the mines closed.
Gary Sanders baits his hook with a worm and casts his line into the river here outside of Deloge, Missouri.
Have you caught anything out of this river before?
I caught a couple of little bass.
Smallmouth?
I think it was smallmouth.
Yeah.
Yeah, they weren't very big. They were only about that big, about 6 inches long.
Sanders is posted up at the Big River. You won't see him or many other fishermen taking home their catch for a fish fry, though.
Big River is kind of the main stream that drains the Old Lead Belt.
Dave Mosby is an environmental contaminant specialist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
It's received a lot of contamination from historic mining operations and milling operations.
Indeed, the State Department of Health and Senior Services has hung up signs that warn visitors about eating the carp or sunfish here.
Those are species of fish in the Big River that ingest a lot of sediment during their normal feeding process, and as a result, they develop a lot of lead in their tissues.
Scientists periodically test the fish tissue, water, and soil here for lead. But these mines are inactive now, so where is this contamination coming from? Mosby and I drive a few miles upstream through the rural town of Leadwood. In 1992, the Environmental Protection Agency listed this area as a Superfund site because the land is contaminated with lead. It poses environmental and human health risks.
Yeah, we are up the hill in the town of Leadwood, looking at the Leadwood pile. There's kind of a series of mill dams that have been improved over the years to try to keep lead tailings in their place. It's not always been effective.
These piles of tailings, which contain concentrations of heavy metals that miners were unable to separate, look like large hills of ground-up gravel or sand.
People have used mine and mill waste as aggregate and sandboxes and driveways and all kinds of different ways.
So, when it rains, the contaminated acreage erodes and trickles into the tributaries that feed the Big River. Government agencies and mining companies like Doe Run have remediated a lot of these piles in the region, but many still feed increments of lead into the Big River.
You know, we think there's about 90 miles of contaminated sediment
Ultimately, Mosby wants to return the river to its pre-mining health. The key is removing contaminated sediment from the river. The best place to do that? At low water crossing areas where today fishermen can walk across the river over what looks like a small, shallow waterfall.
This low water crossing causes the river to slow down upstream, and a lot of the sediment drops out, so it just kind of naturally accumulates here.
Mosby says that's ideal because the contaminated sediment can be removed in these locations without significantly disturbing the flow or balance of the river. He says it's a much more effective strategy than dredging willy-nilly.
Another idea is to actually design structures that serve the same purpose, sediment deposits behind them. You could go in occasionally after each high flow event, remove sediment without causing disruption behind there.
Mosby says state and federal agencies are doing feasibility studies on these ideas, but that they are still a few years away from implementation, and complete cleanup of the river could likely be decades away. Christopher Husted, KBIA News.
From the KBIA Health and Wealth Desk, I'm Ryan Famuliner. In our series on lead, we've heard a lot about lead's economic and social history in Missouri, as well as its health effects on Missourians. Today, we look at how the two intertwine. Bram Sable-Smith takes us to Herculaneum, Missouri, a town that rose and fell with the lead industry.
Bill Haggard is the mayor of Herculaneum, a town of 4,000 about a half hour south of St. Louis. He's also the town's fire chief, president of the Historical Society, a retired teacher. You get the idea. We're driving around the footprint of what used to be downtown Herky, as it's known. The town was built up around a lead smelter that sat here along the Mississippi River for over a century. Today, though, most of the houses that are left are marked with a bright orange X.
They got an X on them. They're coming down. This is getting torn down. All those are coming down. This guy will not sell.
We've known about the bad of lead poisoning for a long time. In the early 1600s, for example, some German states made putting lead sugar into wine punishable by death. But historian David Rosner says it wasn't until the Industrial Revolution that lead poisoning really became pervasive. Even so,
in the 19th century, there was this whole notion that when you took a job, you assumed the risks of the job.
So a worker at the lead smelter in Herculaneum, say, would be assuming the risks of that job. Rosner says that started to change in the early 1900s as researchers around the globe noticed children were starting to show the same symptoms of lead poisoning as industrial workers, caused mostly by lead-based paints in their own homes.
When children got sick, it became apparent that something was wrong with the material that they were crawling in, not necessarily something wrong with the children.
The kids in Herculaneum didn't knowingly assume the risks of living near a smelter either. And Bill Haggard, the mayor, says the lead smelter was just always a part of the town, including for children.
We'd go by it every day. We'd go in there and air up our bike tires. I can remember my dad talking about when he was a kid, he would go in there with his dad and eat lunch. People in town could go down and take showers.
And the smelter would give out slag for free for people to use to melt the ice in their driveways and roads in the winter. But beginning in the late 1990s, some people in town started to question how that lead might be affecting their children. A test of the dust on the town streets found it was 30% lead. And by that time, researchers had started to link even low levels of lead exposure with drops in children's IQ scores and behavior problems like ADHD.
This is not just acting out. This is when kids are impaired, when they can't learn. And half of kids with the diagnosis of ADHD also meet the definition of having a learning disorder.
Bruce Lamphere is a professor of health sciences at Simon Fraser University. He says for a long time, we thought the amount of lead a child was exposed to was proportional with their health problems. But as the average amount of lead exposure in children went down to levels we'd never seen before, the health problems persisted.
We assume that toxic chemicals or pollutants are safe below certain levels. And what we are now finding for lead is that there aren't any safe levels.
And that understanding was the nail in the coffin for the Herculaneum smelter. For years, regulating bodies like the EPA would put in new restrictions, and the lead smelter would try to match them. But those restrictions would get lower and lower. In 2002, the company had to agree to buy out more than 150 lead-contaminated houses, hence the homes marked with an X. Then in 2010, they agreed to close down the smelter for good. Bill Haggard says he never thought he'd live to see that day.
So what's Herculaneum without the lead?
A bedroom community for South St. Louis. There's never going to be another industry. You know, it's just not possible.
For KBIA News, I'm Bram Sablesmith in Herculaneum, Missouri.
For soybean farmers across the country, 2017 will be remembered as a historically destructive year due to the pesticide called dicamba, a weed killer that's been blamed for more than 3.6 million acres of damaged soybeans. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports farmers already are planning for the 2018 planting season with an eye to protecting their crops from whatever pesticides their neighbors spray.
In western Missouri, a farmer drives his combine, harvesting a field of soybeans. He's been averaging about 60 bushels an acre, but not in this field. Here, the plants are shorter. Here, he's a victim.
So far, that field average is running 45 bushels per acre.
And this was one that was hit by a little dicamba drift?
Yeah, that's correct. It was drifted onto.
Saw the cupped leaves and everything.
Right, yeah. Yeah, several people have been out to look at it, and it was covered pretty much from one side to the other.
He doesn't want to be identified because he's also a seed salesman and worried that talking about dicamba will have repercussions for his business and his relationship with chemical and seed companies like BASF and Monsanto. Right now, farmers are facing a dilemma. Should they plant regular seeds or switch to seeds that are genetically modified to withstand dicamba and protect themselves? Those are called Xtend seeds made by Monsanto.
If they're aware that someone close to them is going to spray dicamba, sometimes their choice to buy Xtend soybeans is just for that reason in itself, just so they can reduce the chances of getting any kind of injury as a result of it.
The Environmental Protection Agency approved dicamba in 2016. Since then, more than 2,700 official investigations have been launched into drift damage in about half the U.S., more than 350 in Missouri alone. Drift happens when chemicals move from their intended field onto a neighboring field or orchard with crops that haven't been genetically engineered to survive that pesticide. Weed scientists at universities across the country say the chemical wasn't properly vetted. Monsanto says the product is tremendously successful and user error is to blame for drift damage. In response to the crop damage, the EPA recently set stricter limitations on when and how farmers can spray dicamba.
I've been around forever, and I've never seen an issue like this where if there was a problem, it would be shut down immediately.
Lyndon Brush is a crop consultant in Missouri. Brush says many of the farmers he's been advising are waiting to see what extra restrictions state agriculture departments add.
They need to do something because they cannot continue to have the number of claims that they're having because of one product.
Arkansas and Missouri temporarily banned dicamba earlier this year. Arkansas is the state with the most damage and is looking at instituting a cutoff date for spraying dicamba for next year. Monsanto is challenging that restriction. Regardless of whatever new state rules are put in place next year, more farmers will be planting Xtend seeds, according to Kevin Bradley, a weed specialist at the University of Missouri.
I predict the acreage is going to go up no matter what happens. Some of it is going to go up just because there's people that have been injured 2 years in a row or 1 year and just say, I can't live through that again.
Even Monsanto expects to fill half of the U.S. soybean seed demand for 2018, which would be double what was planted this year. That means 40 million acres of dicamba-tolerant crops. And more dicamba-tolerant crops likely means more dicamba being sprayed. Even so, Bradley says we actually might see fewer soybean acres damaged by drift next year, but other crops, like apples, could be vulnerable.
The soybeans may start fading into the background because there's more and more people adopting the technology, and so there's not going to be as many cases. But that doesn't speak to the trees or the vegetables or any of the other things.
Those additional crops could be the key to how the EPA proceeds with dicamba after the 2018 growing season. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
From the KBIA newsroom in Columbia, I'm Rebecca Smith. Following several months of campus planning, University of Missouri System President Moon Choi outlined the new UM system budget for fiscal year 2018 on Friday. The UM system faces a roughly 6.5% cut in this coming year's state appropriations. And on its flagship campus in Columbia, estimated freshman enrollment has dropped to its lowest level since 2001. Together with unavoidable expense increases and, quote, strategic investments in university sustainability, these pressures created an estimated $60 million revenue shortfall at the Columbia campus alone. System President Moon Choi says the budget cuts and reductions will be difficult, but they are necessary, and by making them, the system can continue to focus on, quote, future excellence across all four campuses.
We're going to be more efficient, reduce redundancies, operate like a system, and that's key, because by operating like a system with unique flavors at each campus, we are going to be able to reap the benefit of that efficiency.
These cuts are the result of Choi's charge earlier this year to all four system campuses to reduce their overall budgets by 8-12%. KBIA's Bram Sable-Smith was at the announcement, and he reports that the budget plan presented by UM System President Choi calls for the elimination of 474 positions across the system's four campuses, about 300 of those on the Columbia campus.
Of the 307 non-student positions being eliminated, 42 are administrative, 173 are staff, and 135 are faculty positions. Not all of those jobs are currently filled, and the numbers include retirements and people who've taken jobs elsewhere. The university's long-term plans for reducing costs will include a review of all of the university's academic programs. Ben Trachtenberg, chair of the MU Faculty Council, says that process needs to include the faculty.
If we are going to decide to eliminate certain programs at MU, that is not a decision that administrators should make and then say to the faculty, what do you think? What the administration ought to say is, let's appoint a committee of respected faculty members, maybe some administrators as well.
The university is planning to hire 161 new faculty for the upcoming school year in, quote, strategic areas. I'm Bram Sable-Smith, KBIA News, Columbia.
And with more on the specific impacts on the University of Missouri-Columbia campus, KBIA's Christopher Husted reports that the MU interim chancellor announced Friday that $60 million in cuts will be made to the Columbia campus. This includes 343 full-time positions and various programs.
The positions cut include staff, faculty, and administration. After recently facing public criticism for a lack of diversity in personnel, system officials pledged to hire more people of color. Interim Chancellor Garnett Stokes says MU leadership remains committed to that goal, even with the layoffs.
I haven't looked at those layoffs, but I don't think that there's going to be any differential impact.
Vice Chancellor for Finance Rhonda Gibler says the Human Resources Department will analyze those layoffs to ensure fairness and equity. Other cuts yet to be named include academic institutes, buildings, and school majors. Stokes says officials will conduct a 12-18-month review process to decide. Christopher Husted, KBIA News.
And in an email received on Friday from the Office of the Chancellor at MU, Interim Chancellor Garnett Stokes reiterated that these cuts were difficult and not easily made. She added that more detailed budget plans at MU will be made available for the MU campus community on Wednesday, June 7th. She ended the email by saying she hopes these cuts and reductions ultimately yield a, quote, stronger, more vibrant Mizzou. For KBIA News, I'm Rebecca Smith.